It's the first of its kind, one-to-one support programme. This is for preschool children who are showing signs of autism. It is about to be trialled in Wellington, with hopes that it'll go nationwide. Professor Josie Barbaro has pioneered the most successful tool for the very early detection of autism in the world. It's known as the Social Attention and Communication Surveillance, or SACS. Identifying autistic children aged 11 to 30 months with an accuracy of 83% and identifying 96% of all autistic children by preschool age. Now, SACS is used around the world, including here in Aotearoa, and it's led to AS Detect, the world's first empirically based early autism detection app for infants and toddlers. Now, Josie's been working on the early signs of autism in babies and toddlers for more than 15 years and is co-founder of Australia's first early assessment clinic for autism, which focuses on children under 3 years old. Now, in a moment, we'll be hearing from Dr. Hannah Waddington, educational psychologist and clinic lead of the Victoria University of Wellington Autism Clinic, Te Rangai Takiwatanga. Hannah's about to roll out Ropi Te Ropo, a world-first programme for under-fives who've shown signs of autism following a SACS or AS Detect assessment. First, though, I asked Principal Research Fellow and Neurodiversity Affirming Psychologist at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Professor Barbaro, to explain what SACS is and how it works.
So it's a developmental surveillance tool, which means that health professionals or educators monitor children's development across time. And it started with my PhD back in 2005, and there were a lot of screening tools out there for autism, but they were all very inaccurate, or they missed a lot of autistic children. So I set out to develop a method where we could train our primary health professionals. So in Australia, that's our maternal child health nurses. In New Zealand, it's your Plunkett and Tamariki Ora nurses. And I developed a series of checklists between 1 and 2 years of age where there were particular social attention and communication behaviours that we know are different in autistic children. And so I developed a training for these nurses. It was about half a day. We trained over 200 nurses, and they screened over 22,000 children with this during their 12, 18 and 24 month checks. And it ended up being the most accurate tool for the early identification of autism, with an accuracy at the time of 81%.
Now, before we go any further with SACS itself, what is the benefit, or what are the benefits of getting an early assessment of autism?
Yeah, so back when I first started, the focus was very heavily on promoting the development of children. And of course, that's still absolutely important, because we know the earlier that we can provide supports and services for children, the better their cognitive outcomes, the better their everyday life skills, and the less stress there is on the family, because they know why their child's different. But what we're also finding now is that research is showing that the earlier that children know that they are autistic, that they are different and not disordered or bad, then the better mental health outcomes. So it's really important that parents, families, and children know that they have a different brain, they have an autistic brain, and that's no less than any other brain. It's just a different brain, and we now need to know how we can best support that child and that family.
Are there already at very early ages certain things that perhaps are less known as being red flags for autism that parents might have been able to pick up or might have been noticing?
Yeah, so look, I think a lot of people are, you know, very aware and probably pay too much attention to whether or not eye contact is present in autistic children or people or not. And if a child can make eye contact, then therefore they can't be autistic. The amount of parents that I've heard that tell me, oh, I took him to the doctor and the doctor said, oh, he makes eye contact, he's not autistic. And that's very problematic because you never base your decision on whether or not a child may be autistic or not on one behavior. Now, of course, eye contact is one of them, but there are many autistic children that make eye contact, but they may do so on their own terms or a little bit differently. So other behaviors that parents may not be aware of are behaviors that we call joint attention behaviors. And this is when children pay attention to the environment and their caregiver, and they share their interest in something by looking at other things and then looking towards their parent. So an example is pointing to things for interest, so birds or planes or just anything of interest, and pointing at it and looking back towards their caregiver and saying, oh, as if to say, you know, this is really cool. Can you see what I see? So they're trying to share their interest with other people. And this is not often seen in autistic children. It can be seen, but it's one of those behaviors that is less common. And the same type of behavior like showing. So when the child might get a present or something that they really like and they're very excited and they pick it up and they show that to their caregivers or to other people. We don't tend to see those types of behaviors as much in young children who are autistic.
So how is it that this particular tool, the social attention and communication surveillance, works? Is it a checklist? Is it just talk us through some of these nuts and bolts of how it's used.
Sure. Yeah, no problem. So what happens is we go out and we train primary health practitioners like nurses, GPs, pediatricians, or early childhood educators. And we train them on how to identify these early signs within the course of their everyday interactions with the children. So whether it be through a health check, whether it be through the course of, you know, their early childhood day. And then they fill out a checklist of these different behaviors. Now, there are only five behaviors that we use to indicate whether a child might be autistic or not between one and two, and there are eight at the preschool age. But there are a number of other things that they can look for as well. And so, for example, at 12 months, we look at eye contact, we look at pointing, we look at imitation, we look at response to name, and then we look at gestures. And if a child is not showing three of five behaviors, then they're at an elevated likelihood of being autistic.
So it's an elevated likelihood. It's not a diagnosis. It's not definitive.
No,
And what's
no
the.
screening tool is ever 100% accurate. That's impossible. So it helps to know whether that child should get supports or to go for an autism assessment.
And how reliable is it?
So it's the most accurate method for early identification in the world. So we did another large trial in 2013, and we monitored over 13,500 children here in Victoria. And of all the children that had a high likelihood of being autistic, 83% went on to receive a diagnosis. And by preschool age, we identified 96% of all autistic children. So it's not only accurate, but it's also very sensitive. It picks up the majority of autistic kids. And the important thing to note is that the remaining children, they're not typically developing, they have developmental or language delays. So they also benefit from being identified early and requiring supports and services. Did you want to talk about the app at all? The
Yes.
AS Detect app.
Yeah, tell me about the app because, or rather, I suppose, with the tool, how is it, how's it being rolled out through the app? How does that work?
Yeah, so I was in Wellington about a month ago and trained over 300 health professionals, Plunket nurses, GPs, paediatricians, and early childhood educators on how to use this developmental surveillance tool. And, you know, that was so well received and it was just a fantastic trip. And along with that, I also educated everybody about this app that we developed called AS Detect. And it's available free on Google and Apple platforms, and it's for parents. So parents can download this app for free, And it has these checklists between 1 year of age and 2.5 years of age that parents can watch videos of these social communication milestones and then fill out that checklist. And then it shows parents the likelihood of that child being autistic or not and what to do next. And the reason why this app is so good is because there are a lot of parents who are quite scared to take that initial step to go to their doctor and say, I'm concerned about my child. So it gives them the opportunity to monitor their child's development at home in the comfort of their own home and then decide what to do next when they receive those results.
And what's the name of the app?
So it's AS Detect. And if you pop that into Google or Apple platforms, it'll come up and it's available in English, Mandarin, Spanish, and in Slovak and also in Polish soon.
Autism, as you've described, can present very differently in different children. And is it particularly something that between boys and girls can often appear in very different ways?
Yeah, so in the age range that I work in most, so that's in infants and toddlers, we've actually done research to try to see if there are any differences in these social communication behaviors between boys and girls. And we're really not finding any differences. The girls have slightly increased skills in language, but overall, we're not finding any differences. And that's because children are their most authentic self when they're infants and toddlers. They do not understand societal rules. You go to the supermarket, a child wants a chocolate and they don't get one. They're going to have some of them a meltdown over that. And that's because they don't really understand that that's maybe not the best place to be doing that. But what happens, towards preschool age and above, girls are more likely to start to mask or what we call camouflage their differences because they want to fit in. Now, that's not to say that boys don't do that, but girls tend to do that more. And so once children reach about preschool age and over, then some of our girls start to get missed because they're hiding these differences. And what parents tell me is that, they go to school and they're reported as, the perfect child. And again, this isn't all autistic girls, but a lot of them, the perfect child, they sit and they listen and they have no issues with them. But as soon as they come home, they completely explode because they've been minimizing and repressing these differences all day. And it is absolutely exhausting. And so what parents see at home is different to what happens at school. And so parents then feel at their wits' end because they see these differences at home, but the teachers just don't at school.
And what are some of the misconceptions, I suppose, about the condition, about autism? And also the diagnosis level. Is it something that's being diagnosed more these days?
Yeah, so the diagnostic rates or the prevalence of autism has definitely increased over the years. But what I've found when I'm mapping, I guess, the increases in prevalence with our changes in our definition of autism, they map pretty closely onto that. So when autism was first entered into our manuals for diagnosis, the rate was 1 in 5,000 because the definition of autism was very, very narrow. And it essentially only included those children who also had an intellectual disability. But as we became much more aware of the spectrum and how wide that spectrum is and how autism presents differently in so many different people, then we've broadened the criteria to include those children who would not have gotten diagnosed in the past, and same with adults as well. So the prevalence now is about 2% of the population, and we're thinking that that might increase to about 5% because in the past you couldn't diagnose autism and ADHD at the same time. So a lot of our ADHD kids who are autistic weren't diagnosed. So I think that it'll probably go up to about 5%, and it really is because of our increased awareness. Excuse me. And
And
it
because,
really is because of our, would you like me to repeat that again?
absolutely. You go.
Yep. And it's because of our increased awareness of the differences in how autism presents across different people that, our prevalence rates have increased and our increased knowledge of it.
That's so interesting about ADHD and autism together, because it certainly seems to be becoming more accepted that those two are often conditions that travel together.
Well, absolutely. The co-occurrence of autism and ADHD is 80% and above. And so we literally were not allowed to diagnose autism and ADHD in the same person until 2013 when our manuals changed. And so, that's pretty crazy. That's only 11 years ago. So there is an entire generation of children and adults who were diagnosed as only ADHD when in fact they were both. And so that's why I get quite frustrated when people say, oh, TikTok and social media and all the rest of it is what's causing the increase. But actually, it's because of all of these changes in our manuals. It's because of increased awareness. And a lot of our ADHDers are now being diagnosed as also autistic.
Some other misconceptions are certainly another one that is quite prevalent. Do people who have autism have superpowers? This is the Rain Man one.
Yeah, so I mean, again, another huge misconception, and one that actually a lot of people in the autistic community, can be quite offended about because, these what we, they're called splinter skills. When you can do something that's extraordinary in comparison to the rest of your development, because autistic people and those with other disabilities, are just like everybody else in that there are some people that are gifted and have, these amazing skills, and then some that are, that don't. And yes, it may be more prevalent or likely in the autistic community, but it's not a superpower. Autistic people are just like everybody else, and some do have extraordinary skills, and others don't. So the misconception that autism or other neurodivergences like ADHD comes with a superpower is just not accurate.
Just finally, to get a sense of what would happen if if your child was identified by the use of this tool as having a sort of a raised likelihood, I suppose, of having autism, what would be the next step for whānau, for parents or caregivers that they would take? Is this where they would get an actual diagnosis?
Yeah, so really, this is, I guess, the first step in getting that family and that child on the right path for early supports. Now, what we're doing in Australia through our National Disability Insurance Scheme, and I know that also there's this movement in New Zealand as well, is that we're moving away from diagnosis being the ticket to getting supports and identifying those children who are likely to need that support, and that's what the SACS does, and providing that support from the get-go. And then in parallel, organizing the diagnostic process because the wait lists are so long for diagnosis. And so it's really about identifying that a child is at a high likelihood of being autistic, and on the SACS, it's extremely high, 83%, and then the rest of the children require developmental or language support. Getting them into services such as occupational therapy, psychology, speech therapy, play therapy, any community groups. Autism New Zealand have some really fantastic programs. And then, in parallel to that, waiting for an autism diagnostic assessment, but not delaying support before then. And that's why the program that we're doing in New Zealand, which you'll be talking about with Hannah later, is really fantastic because we're developing a streamlined pathway between early identification of children who are likely to be autistic and getting them into supports as soon as possible.
That's Associate Professor Josephine Barbaro from Australia's La Trobe University. And with us now, Dr. Hannah Waddington of Victoria University of Wellington's Autism Clinic. Te rangai takiwātanga. That is the clinic there. And she's with us now. Kia ora, good morning.
Kia ora.
How does your work pair with Professor Barbaro's that we were hearing about there in Australia. What are the kind of the rollouts here that you've been able to mirror with hers?
Yes, so my special area of interest is support, whereas Josie does that early identification piece. So as part of this broad research project, we had Josie, who we've just heard is amazing, come over from Australia and train over 300 health and education professionals in the Wellington region to identify early signs of autism. After that, that's where we come in at the autism clinic. So exactly as Josie was saying, we really don't want to be waiting for that diagnosis to provide support. So instead, those children identified by those professionals that we trained who are showing signs of autism get referred directly to our clinic with the hope that we'll be providing support to them much sooner.
And what do the supports look like?
So we're really excited about the program of support that we've developed. It's called Raupi Te Raupō. The name was gifted to us by Associate Professor Meres Garrett. So Raupō, you might be familiar with, is the bulrush plant that you find in the wetland ecosystem that's really valuable, important part of the ecosystem, really valuable to Māori, and Raupi is the idea of nurturing or cherishing. So the program's about kind of nurturing and cherishing our children and our whānau exactly as we would that Raupō plant. So I won't go on and on about it forever, but over the past year, we've been developing this program completely from the ground up, alongside autistic people and alongside Māori. So we had these advisory groups. We met once a month and we said, okay, what does the support need to look like, you know? How should it be delivered? What strategies should we be using? What outcomes do we want to be focusing on? And now we've got it to the stage where it's being ready to roll out at a much larger scale.
Okay, because what are the challenges that parents or caregivers or whānau come up against when they're trying to work out what is up with their baby, if they've figured out that there's something a bit different? And, you know, accessing help can be very tricky.
Yes.
Because often people are very keen to reassure you that, you know, oh, your baby's fine. And they are fine.
Yeah.
But they might also be autistic.
Yes. So I think one thing that we know about New Zealand and a lot of places worldwide is that we're just not picking up the signs of autism when we should be. So some recent research done in New Zealand suggests that on average, parents are noticing signs of autism within their child maybe around 3 years old. And then the average age of diagnosis in a recent study was 6.5. So, and we know from what Josie was saying, that many children can be reliably diagnosed perhaps even around the age of 2, and a lot of children are showing those signs around 1. So the fact that, you know, those concerns even from parents are coming a lot later, and then the diagnosis is coming way after that, it's a real big problem, and we could be doing so much better. And I think there's so many layers to this, and one of them is that lack of knowledge of signs of autism amongst those professionals who most frequently interact with their child. So that's exactly why we're trying to train, you know, blanket nurses, early childhood educators, GPs, all those people who frequently interact with the child to be able to identify those signs earlier. And I think another thing that you touch on there is the idea of the child not able to be fine if they're showing signs of autism, right? So a lot of what Josie does in her trainings is fight against that stigma that autism is a bad or a scary thing, instead of a brain-based difference that we can understand and support with.
A couple of questions that sort of touch on some of the things that you've just been talking about here. One from Helen saying, please ask about the absence of crawling or delayed crawling is a sign of neurodivergence. Is this a sign in babies?
So I guess one thing about autism or any forms of neurodivergence is that it can show in differences across a wide area of development, right? But I wouldn't say that differences in crawling per se are one of those key signs, for example, that Josie is asking us to look for. So when we're thinking about autism specifically, we're thinking more about those differences in social communication, although of course every child is different, and if we're also seeing those other delays, that's another area for investigation and assessment.
Okay, Helen, thank you for your question. Another one in asking, can children diagnosed early with autism outgrow the diagnosis?
Yeah, so that's, I think, a really fascinating one. So we do think of autism as an identity and not something that goes away. So when we're thinking about identifying a child early and perhaps putting appropriate supports in place, what we've seen in research conducted by Josie is that perhaps the need for support decreases because of this effective early support that a child has had. So we might see a child going into school and needing less support, thriving in a mainstream environment, which we would love to see, but we wouldn't be saying that they were no longer autistic. They would still have their same kind of different brain. It just might be that they don't need so much support, which is awesome for them, right?
How overloaded is the system?
Very.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the exact reason for my research, really, and that really late diagnosis often that I was talking about compared to what we could be achieving. So the Child Development Service, who does the diagnosis of children publicly, everyone I know in that system is amazing. But the resources are just not there to diagnose the amount of children who are coming in. When we think of what's needed for a diagnosis, it's often a multidisciplinary team, a speech-language therapist, a paediatrician, a psychologist, an occupational therapist. They're really thorough in what they do. They need to visit the school and things like that. So in order to diagnose all the children who are coming through, it simply cannot be done at the level of funding. And what that results in is very long waiting lists. So anecdotally, a lot of the families in our clinic will be waiting a year or more for diagnosis, and I know that often diagnosis in younger children is prioritised. So when I hear about children at school age looking for a diagnosis, the wait is often much longer than a year. And there's also inequality across areas of New Zealand. So people in Northland, for example, I've heard waiting an even longer time than this year, for example, that we might be seeing in young children in Wellington.
There's been a bit of an emphasis shift perhaps here, and I wonder how much of this is around cultural response and as you were talking about earlier with the programme, looking at it as a difference rather than a deficit. Yeah. And to be protective of our tamariki while at the same time acknowledging that difference.
Yes, so I really love this move towards being more affirming of autistic brains. When you take a lens of being neurodiversity affirming, that idea of different kinds of brains within society is a really valuable thing, you know? We don't want to have all of the same kind of brains because we have a lot of different tasks, a lot of different ways to be successful and things that need to be done in society. So for me, I think the idea of difference is beautiful, but I also have heard from autistic people that it's very important not to think that difference washes away what's difficult or challenges, right? So I think a real misconception about this move towards difference is that there can't also be a huge area of need or of support, and that things sometimes can't be hard for autistic people. You know, there's a lot of anxiety or mental health issues, perhaps because the systems in society aren't set up for them. So I think it's really beautiful to embrace those differences and also acknowledge that the need for support, the need for society to change is still there.
It's interesting that the because diagnosis can often be difficult and expensive to get, there is a bit of a move away from that requirement from accessing services. How does that actually work in practice, though? Because if you don't have a diagnosis, how easy is it to open that door?
Yeah, so Josie touched on the idea that many services in New Zealand don't have a diagnostic barrier, although some do. Mm. So, for example, the Ministry of Education should be providing support to children based on need rather than a diagnosis that I know that they may or may not have. In our clinic, that's one of the most important things to us, is that we don't have a diagnostic barrier for entering our service. We're an early support service, so we simply wouldn't be seeing enough children if we required that diagnosis in order for them to be able to access it. So for us, all we need is for that child to be showing sufficient signs of autism on that SACS tool. And exactly as Josie said, that family will be going through the diagnostic process. They may or may not be diagnosed eventually. In fact, we know that some children showing signs won't end up having an autism diagnosis.
This is interesting because it is, we talk about it being a spectrum now, with, you know, ASD level 1, 2 and 3, depending on the severity, if you like. I don't know if that's the right word. But I guess that would indicate that there's a bit before you get to ASD level 1 where people might have some characteristics of autism, but not enough to actually have a diagnosis. But that would still potentially be life-changing and impact on their lives.
Yeah, so I firmly believe that the support that we've developed, it's really gentle, it's really respectful, and it's quite broad. Even if that child never goes on to receive an autism diagnosis, there's going to be these support areas going on. That's what we know about Josie's tool. They might have some language delays or some other areas. So we've got in there, we've supported them, and from our perspective, we're not really so concerned if they go on to receive this official clinical diagnosis of autism or not. We're just simply working with the child who's in front of us.
A couple more questions before we wrap up that have been coming in from our audience here. Someone asking, is there a similarity between an autistic child and behaviours that parents would label as, in quotes, highly sensitive? You hear this being used with babies in particular sometimes. Or is this potentially that we're looking at two different things here?
Yeah, so I wouldn't want to say too much on, I guess, the concept of highly sensitive. That's not, you know, within our diagnostic criteria or things. But I do hear from autistic people that there can be, for themselves or for others, some, sensitivity to what others say. You know, an example might be thinking that there's an intention to something when there's not, someone accidentally bumps into you in the corridor or something like that, taking that really personally because it's hard for that child to know, oh, that was just an accident, they didn't mean it, versus the intention behind it. So there's definitely within some children that we support, I guess what we could call a sensitivity, but that's not commonly language that we specifically would use.
Okay, another person asking, is there a link between autism and dyslexia? We talked a little bit with Josie about the ADHD link. What about other neurodivergencies?
Yes, so there's this umbrella category of neurodevelopmental conditions which has things in it such as global developmental delay, ADHD, dyslexia, dyspraxia, which is difficulties with motor coordination. And we know that there's a lot of co-occurrence between these conditions. So it's indeed true that if you are autistic, you're also more likely to be dyslexic. If you've got that different brain in one kind of way, you might have it in another kind of way too.
Just very briefly, is autism still seen and categorised, and should it be, as a disability?
Yes, so I think when I talk to autistic people, they will often describe autism as a disability, and they don't necessarily think that there's a stigma around that idea of disability. And I think that's often because when you take an affirming view of autism, what's disabling is not within yourself but within society. The way society is set up, they are disabled because the systems aren't in place to best support them.